Black Brew. Astro was willing to agree to a reasonable division of the belt. We never wanted to fight. It was Humphreys who started the rough stuff. Stavanger pursed his lips. I guess it all depends, then, on how you define the word reasonable. Hey, look, Pancho said. There's enough raw materials in the belt to satisfy everybody. Plenty for all of us. It's Humphreys who wants to take it all. Are you talking about me, Pancho? They turned and saw Humphreys striding through the door, looking relaxed and confident in a dark blue business suit. Nothing I haven't said to your face, Humphy, old buddy, Pancho replied. Humphreys raised an eyebrow. I'd appreciate it if you referred to me as Mr. Humphreys when the other delegates get here.
Sensitive?
Yes. In return for your consideration, I'll try to refrain from using phrases such as gutter snipe or grease monkey. Stavanger put a hand to his forehead. This is going to be a lovely morning, he groaned.
Actually, the conference went along much more smoothly than Stavanger had feared. The other delegates arrived, and Humphreys turned his attention to Amanda, who smiled politely at him, but said very little. He seemed almost to be a different person when Fuchs's wife was near. Polite, considerate, earnestly trying to win her admiration, or at least her respect. Stavanger called the meeting to order, and everyone took seats along the polished oblong conference table. Pancho behaved like a proper corporate executive, and Humphreys was affable and cooperative. Each of them made an opening statement about how they wanted nothing more than peace and harmony in the asteroid belt. Willie Dieterling then said a few brief words about how important the resources of the belt were to the people of Earth. With so many millions homeless and hungry, with so much of our global industrial capacity wiped out, we desperately need the resources from the belt, he pleaded. This fighting is disrupting the supply of raw materials that we need to recover from the climate catastrophe that has brought civilization to its knees. Stavanger pointed out, the people of Selene are ready to help as much as we can. We have industrial capacity here on the moon, and we can help you to build factories and power generation stations in Earth orbit. It was Big George who ended the platitudes. We all want peace and brotherhood, he began. But the painful truth is that people are killing each other out in the belt. Dieterling immediately replied. The world government is prepared to offer peacekeeping troops to you, to help you maintain order in the belt. No thanks, George snapped. We can maintain order for ourselves. He turned to look squarely at Humphreys. If the corporations will stop sending killers to us. Corporations plural? Pancho asked. Astro hasn't sent any killers to the belt. You sent your share of goons, Pancho, said George. To protect our property. Humphreys made a hushing motion with both hands. I presume you're both referring to certain actions taken by employees of Humphreys Space Systems. Fucking right, George blurted. With all eyes on him, Humphreys said calmly, It's perfectly true that some of the people my corporation sent to Ceres have been, well, roughnecks. Murderers, George muttered. One man committed a murder, true enough, Humphreys conceded. But he acted on his own, and he was punished for it swiftly enough. By Lars Fuchs, I understand, said Dieterling. Humphreys nodded. Now we're getting down to the crux of the problem. Wait a minute, George interjected. Let's not start dumping on Lars. Plenty of ships have been knocked off in the belt, and it was HSS that started it. That's not true, Humphreys said. Isn't it? I was fucking attacked by one of your butcher boys. Took me arm off, remember? We went through an IAA hearing over that. No one was able to prove it was one of my ships that attacked you. That doesn't mean it wasn't one of them, does it now? Stavanger broke into the budding argument. Unless we have concrete evidence, there's no use throwing accusations around. George glowered at him, but said nothing. We do have concrete evidence, Humphreys resumed with a swift glance at Amanda, that Lars Fuchs has attacked ships, killed men, stolen supplies, and now he's wiped out a base we were building on Vesta in a totally unwarranted and premeditated attack. He's killed several dozen people. He's the reason for all this violence out in the belt, and until he's caught and put away, the violence will continue. Absolute silence. Not one of the men or women seated around the conference table said a word in Fuchs's defense. Not even Amanda, Humphreys noted with unalloyed delight.
The asteroid had no name. In the catalog files, it was merely 38-4002. Barely a kilometer long, and half that at its widest, it was a dark, carbonaceous body, a loose aggregation of pebble-sized chondrules, more like a beanbag than a solid rock. Fuchs had left one of his transceivers there weeks earlier. Now he was returning to the asteroid to retrieve it and see what information Amanda had been able to beam to him. "She's gone to Cellini," he kept repeating in his mind. "To a conference. To Humphreys. Without telling me. Without mentioning a word of it." He saw St. Clair's face again as the man told him the news, almost smirking. "Your wife didn't tell you?" he heard St. Clair ask again and again. "She never even mentioned it to you?" "It's probably in a message just waiting for me," Fuchs told himself. "Amanda must have put it into the latest batch of messages just before she left for Cellini, for Humphrey's home." His guts knotted like fists every time he thought of it. "Why didn't she tell me beforehand?" he raged silently. "Why didn't she discuss this with me before she decided to go?" The answer seemed terribly clear. "Because she didn't want me to know she was going. Didn't want me to know she would be seeing Humphreys." He wanted to bellow his rage and frustration, wanted to order his crew to race to Cellini, wanted to take Amanda off the ship that was carrying her to the moon and keep her safely with him. Too late, he knew. Far too late. She's gone. She's there by now. She's left me. Nautilus's propellant tanks were full. Fuchs felt a slight pang of conscience about taking the hydrogen and helium fuels from his one-time friend St. Clair, but he had no choice. He had left St. Clair on less than friendly terms, but nevertheless, the Quebecois waited 6 full hours before putting in an emergency call for a tanker, as Fuchs had ordered him to do. Shaking his head as he sat in the command chair on Nautilus's bridge, Fuchs wondered at how the human mind works. "St. Clair knew I wouldn't harm him. Yet he waited the full 6 hours before calling for help, giving me plenty of time to get safely away. Is he still my friend, despite everything? Or was he afraid I'd come back and fire on him?" Pondering the question, Fuchs decided, most likely St. Clair was simply playing it safe. "Our friendship is dead. A casualty of this war. I have no friends. I have no wife, either. I've driven her away. Driven her into Humphreys' territory, perhaps into his arms." The Asian navigator, seated to one side of the bridge, said to the woman who was piloting the ship, "The rock is in visual range." He spoke in their native Mongol dialect, but Fuchs understood them. "It's not a rock," he corrected silently. "It's an aggregate." Glad to have something else to occupy his mind, Fuchs commanded his computer to put the telescopic view of the asteroid on his console screen. It was tumbling slowly along its long axis, end over end. As they approached the roid, Fuchs called up the computer image that showed where they had planted the transceiver. He hunched forward in his chair, studying the screen, trying to drive thoughts of Amanda out of his mind. It showed the telescope's real-time image of the asteroid with the computer's grid map superimposed over it. "Strange," he thought. "The contour map doesn't match the visual image anymore. There's a new lump on the asteroid, not more than 50 meters from where the transceiver should be sitting." Fuchs froze the image and peered at it. The asteroids were dynamic, he knew. They're constantly being dinged by smaller chunks of rock. An aggregate like this roid wouldn't show a crater, necessarily. It's like punching your fist into a beanbag chair. It just gives and reforms itself. But a lump? What would cause a lump? He felt an old, old fervor stirring inside him. Once he had been a planetary geochemist. He had first come out to the belt to study the asteroids, not to mine them. A curiosity that he hadn't felt in many years filled his mind. What could raise a blister on a carbonaceous chondritic asteroid?
Doric Harbin was half a day's journey distant from the carbonaceous asteroid, even at the 0.5G acceleration that was Shenadar's best speed.